Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the QuickBook Reviews podcast. Brighten your day with a book.
Hello, my fellow bookworms. This is Philippa from QuickBook Reviews, author interviews and book reviews. How are you all doing? So my question of the day, it's a bit weird, I know, but what would you say if someone overtook you while you're running? Because this is happening to me on a very regular basis. To begin with, I was embarrassed about it. Well, probably I still am, but I'm trying to come up with comments that are funny to the people that are overtaking me. I don't know why, because most of them are very serious runners. You know, the sort, the ones that they don't even listen to anything. They're not listening to a story. They're not listening to an audiobook or a podcast. They're not listening to music. They're just there with their own thoughts. They're often wearing shorts, even if it's in winter. They have some sort of fluorescent tabard thing going on, and they are just very serious about what they're doing. Whereas there's me, flapping around, having a, well, would I have a lovely time running? No, but I'm listening to something that I'm enjoying. And I just try and come up with something. So my current thing that I say when I'm overtaken is, oh, you've had your Weetabix today. But that's wearing a bit thin. I think I've used that too many times. This morning, I found myself saying to this professional runner as they went past, well done, as if I was, you know, admiring and giving them feedback on their running skills. So some of the very serious ones just don't talk. They're very focused. I don't know. What's the world coming to? Anyway, that's my question of the day. What do you say when you're overtaken by runners? The other question of the day is, how many of the books that I'm going to tell you about will you want to get? All of them, I'm afraid, is the answer to that. So coming up in today's episode, we have In the Blink of an Eye by Joe Callahan, The Man I Never Met by Elle Cook, Daisy Darker by Alice Feeney, The Bleeding by Johanna Gustafson, and The Confession by Maureen Myant. And if you listened to last week's episode where I was talking to Karen from Arenda Books and Adrian and Rebecca from Hobet Books, they were talking about these two books and I promised I would review them. And I have read them and I am ready to spill the beans on those. So more on that later. But let's get started on the interviews. We've got two author interviews today. And the first one I'm thrilled to talk to you about is Joe Callahan, who has written In the Blink of an Eye. Let me tell you about this book. Here is the blurb. Well, there's two different blurbs. I'm going to go for this blurb. Here we go. Sorry. Me and my blurbs. One blurb, two blurbs. Which blurb to choose? Here we go. DCS Kat Frank knows all about loss. A widowed single mother, Kat is a cop who trusts her instincts. Picked to lead a pilot program that has her paired with an AIDE, artificially intelligent detecting entity, Locke. Kat's instincts come up against Locke's logic when two missing persons' cold cases suddenly become active. Let's do the first sentence. Earlier. He can't see. He tries opening his eyes, but something traps them tight against his skull. He gropes at his face with slow, clumsy fingers. A blindfold? Bandage? What the actual? He tugs at it first with one hand, then more desperately with two. But it's no use. It's too tight. This book, when I heard about this book, see, I love crime. You know I love crime. And to hear about a crime book where one of the detective partners is AI. I was like, yeah, I am so sold on this. This has got me written all over it. And I really enjoyed it. It's a sort of, it, for me, it's like a crime thriller. And the story is, it went, it kept me gripped. I was wondering what was going to happen. I was trying to work out what, you know, who the baddie was. There's always a baddie. Who is the baddie? And there were the twists that I liked, the reveal. And I'm just hoping this is going to be a series, because I want more of this. In some ways, it wasn't, but they reminded me a bit of the Poe and Tilly partnership with M.W. Craven, Mike Craven. And clearly, Tilly and Poe, there's no AI there. But if you've read Mike Craven's books and then you read Blink of an Eye, I think you'll see what I'm getting at. Just something rang a bell for me there. But I love this. It's unique, it's different, and that's what I like. So, yeah, I think we need to go and talk to Joe straight away. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome to the podcast Joe Callahan. Joe, welcome.
Hello, I'm Sam. I'm more excited than you. This is my first ever podcast interview. And absolutely, and also, you are my favourite podcast, but don't tell anybody else.
Oh my goodness, I'm so excited to talk to you about this book. I always drone on about how I want to read books that are different in a good way. And yours is absolutely that. It's just what I needed, a breath of fresh air. So bravo. How did you come up with the idea for this?
Well, I've been writing for over 12 years. I began writing, it took me a long time, middle grade initially. I think I started writing when I was 40, so I'm 53 now, so my 40th birthday, because my children were younger. And I think that's why I started writing middle grade, because I was mostly reading books for them. Didn't get those published. Then I moved into YA and got a bit better. But then as the children grew older, I found I was reading more crime and thrillers, and people I was following on Twitter, the people I really admired, were working that genre. And to be honest, then I saw people just having a really good time at Harrogate Crime Festival. And I just thought, I'd really like, oh, I should write, I want to go to Harrogate, I should write a crime thriller. And other people, friends said, oh, you should, yeah, do it. And then I thought, actually, maybe I should, because actually that is what I read. And these are the writers I admire are in that genre. So I thought I'd write a crime book, but then I couldn't really think of anything different, because there's so much out there, so many good books. I couldn't find anything that really excited me enough to think I could add anything different. And then in my work, I was doing some research on the future impact of AI on the workforce, just over several months, sort of in the background. And then I was reading Dan Brown, Origin. Mm. Novel. And at the end of that, he's got an AI assistant, Robert Langford. Just in the last few chapters, he gets an AI assistant that he places in his ear that helps him solve the last elements of the crime. I just thought, oh, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? How if he had an AI detective? So I had a quick look online, thinking, and actually, to my surprise, they are already being piloted in terms of AI machinery, so computational models, not actual holograms, as I use in the book. But there are lots of pilots in Britain, Europe and America trying to use AI algorithms and machines to actually help in the policing front, and all the issues they raise and about how we make decisions, about how you evidence versus instinct, whether that data is biased and whether you're sort of ploughing back in human prejudices back into machines, all the ethical issues. I just got fascinated by it. I thought, God, this would be great, not just to have a crime novel, but one that starts to unpack and expose all these really ethical, political issues about how we make decisions, particularly about crime and justice. And I had this idea, which was about sort of 2017, and I thought, God, someone's bound to have, so obvious, someone must have done it. They didn't say anybody else. And then my husband became very ill with lung cancer, and I had to put all the writing on hold. So didn't write much at all in those years. But then when he did die, sadly, in early 2019, January 2019, I think I said before, that was the way I coped, really. I started to write that book within weeks of the funeral, just a way to sort of stop myself from going completely mad. It was just, I needed to fill the nights with something. So I thought, right, I'll write this book. So I did that first draft in 3 months, primarily as a survival technique. But so that's how we got the idea, and that's why I did it. So it's a very long answer.
No, it's a perfect answer. And as a reader, the book just drew me in and sort of consumed me. So was it able to do that for you? I mean, obviously you can't ignore all the awful situation you're in, but did it really consume you when you were able to put pen to paper?
It did. So as I say, I'd written, I think, probably four novels before. And this was the easiest one to write. I think because I based the main character, DCS Cat Frank, is a middle-aged widow detective. I thought I just kind of based partly, I mean, she's not wholly me, but I did think, you know, what would I be like if I joined the police force at 20? Somebody with my sort of personality, what kind of... And I thought, I'll develop a more sophisticated character later, but for now, I'll just make her sort of a bit like me because that'll just be easier. And I just did it. And I already had the plot. So I'm very plot-led. So I kind of knew, all the major key plot points. And yeah, I just wrote it every night because I had nothing else to do other than grieve. So... yeah, it did consume me, but I don't remember an awful lot about writing. I just remember it sounds awful, but it was very easy to write that first draft. Although having said that, so although the plot didn't really change, some really trusted, lovely beta writers and my agent, they all said it's great, but it's a bit miserable, you know, because I think I was processing my own. There were lots more scenes in there with probably about Kat and her grieving. So my agent very bravely and wisely said to me, "This has got real potential, it's really good, but you've written this for you, and if you want to get it published, you now need to write it for crime readers." So that's when I did another draft, so not really changing the plot, but maybe having maybe less domestic scenes or placing them, pacing them sort of a bit differently, which was, you know, that's my agent, Sue Armstrong. And I don't think many people would have had the courage or insight to say that to somebody. I think it's quite easy to say to... particularly a recent widow, "Oh, that's great, it's very moving." So I really admire her for actually saying to me, "You need to write this for crime readers now."
But how easy was that? Because it was so much a part of what you'd gone through. Could you come to terms with changing the book?
Yeah, there weren't big changes. It was just having less miserable scenes and trying to be less miserable. And upping the humour. I mean, there are some, so I've worked quite a lot of humour into it as well, which hopefully I find funny. So the interactions between Kat and Locke, in terms of, you know, its algorithms-based approach compared to her gut instinct, sort of saying, you know, her trying to explain to Locke why it can't tell a mom that there's a, you know, 90% probability that her son is dead, you know, but that is not a great thing to do.
Yeah.
So I just tried to sort of, I guess, increase some of the humour, the pace, and have those domestic scenes, but space it so they come later rather than earlier on. So there weren't huge changes. It was more about moving things around, dialing some things down, and being clear about who I was writing it for. I think her key insight was that first draft. I absolutely did write it for me. So I didn't write it to be published. I just didn't care, which might have been why it's the best book I've ever written and it got published, because I literally did write it for me. I wasn't even sure I'd show it to my agent. It took me quite a while to make that decision, because it was literally just for me.
And it's not a science fiction or dystopian. And as you said, the research shows it's already being used in some ways.
I wrote it so it's just in the near future. So I don't specify which year, but the idea is it's several years. It's sort of now, but just the very near future. So maybe 3, 4, 5 years from now. So that's the sort of conceit I'm trying to pull off. So it's not sci-fi. So it is very much now. All the aspects I talk about AI are either with us now or imminent on the horizon, with the exception of Locke's live conversational abilities. They don't yet exist, but there's a lot of money research going into that.
And I thought it really helped the feelings in the book, because yes, okay, the AI doesn't have feelings, and yet the example and the difference between the characters there was a lot of emotion, I thought, in that.
Yeah, that's what I tried to do. Locke obviously is a machine which is programmed with algorithms, but it's capable of deep learning. So what I'm trying to show in this book and in future books is the journey that it goes on, because initially, it is very, very literal necessarily. You ask it to do a task, it will do it quite literally. But as it interacts more with humans, then it should, in theory, be able to learn more in terms of how to interact, how to mimic feelings. Now, again, arguably, it as a machine, it can never have feelings. So cat is very sort of, it is a machine, it has no feelings. But I'm trying to pose the question. I leave it ambiguous in terms of, so that you might be able to infer that, is it developing feelings? And for that, I do on research. If you think about Star Trek with Spock, or The Terminator, one of my favourite films. So I try and sort of leave it sort of open to the reader. So if you want to believe they're developing feelings, you could do that. But I'm hoping to develop that as the series develops, to the extent to which a lot can or may do develop what we would call feelings.
Yes, you've mentioned the word series, and that is something I very much wanted to talk to you about, because, yes, I am hoping that this is part of what's going to be a very long series. Can you confirm you've got a 20-book deal with your publisher?
Well, if you could mention that to my publisher, that'd be really helpful. It was a 2-book deal. So I've written book 2, or decent. I haven't yet sent it to my editor and agent, and I've got plans for book 3 and book 4. So if I were contracted, I'm hoping I will be able to write more, but that all depends on your lovely listeners buying book 1.
Well, and we need to talk about the timing of this, because normally people come on the podcast when their book is already published, but you and I are doing this. The episode will go out about a month before the book is published. And there are various reasons for that, but also I think it's useful to get these pre-orders in for you, because that can have such an impact upon the success of the book. Did the publishers talk to you about pre-orders at all?
No, not really. They don't. I've only picked up, I've been on Twitter for many years, how important pre-orders are. There's something I never understood before as a reader. I would think, you know, I'd support a book and maybe buy it the second, third week. I've only recently understood that pre-orders count as your first week sales, and those first week sales are what count for chart position and all the other signifiers of success that then lead into whether it be the algorithms within the Amazon world, or putting a sticker on, or getting future book deals. It's all this crazy world of publishing, isn't it, in terms of what success entails. And so pre-orders as a vote of confidence that then inspires other people's confidence seems to be really, really important. But it's a big ask from readers to pre-order an unknown book from an unknown author, you know, in these times. I'm amazed. I mean, people have been really kind in what they've said and bought already. And I think, crikey, you know, because it is a big ask, isn't it?
Yeah, and there are a lot of books being published all the time, and yet there aren't as many really good ones. Does it feel like it's a competitive space, or are you just looking forward to publication day?
The honest answer is I think, God, there's so many books that I can't keep up with them. And, you know, there are so many. And that's why I said to a friend when I wrote the book, I said that the world doesn't need to read my book. Yeah, there are enough books out there, but I needed to write it. And so when I sent it to my agent, and I'd gone out in submission twice before with 2 YA books and got close to being published but never, and the second one just devastated me. Going out in submission is a whole new level of, you know, emotional anxiety. And when that second one didn't get taken by publisher, I just thought, God, I'll never write again. That's it. I was just too damaged. And it was while my husband was really ill as well. So I put all the and it was, that book was also about loss and stuff. So I just thought, that's it, I'm done. I can't mentally cope with this. And then I thought, right, so I'm going to write a blog post about how I'm giving up writing. And then, you know, I made this decision, and then I just thought, oh my God, listen to yourself. You're going to write a blog post about you giving up writing? You know, apart from get over yourself, if my response to give up writing is to write about it, I'm not good. What I decided to do was give up trying to get published. And that's, I think, what freed me to write this book. I just thought, I write because I needed to write it. I make it as good as I could. So I've kind of, it's not about competing with others, but I just think it's a very, very crowded market. And I'm trying not to get too sucked into all of that. I didn't write it to compete with others, but it is a really, really crowded market. And there are so many good books out there. I don't have enough time to read them all. As I say, so people don't need to read my book. It'd be lovely if they did, but I completely understand if they've got, you know, huge to be. It is quite pressured, I think, for everybody.
But it is a book that has got a great story, but in some ways it's easy to read because, you know, you just make it easy on the reader. It's not one that someone's got to steel themselves to get through. The concept is great. The AI sidekick is just super, and you're just into the story. So, and also, yes, it might be a busy marketplace, but it's not a busy area. You've got your own little area of crime thriller fiction here. You've created a whole new area and everyone else needs to stay out. So that's great.
But yeah, there might be a good reason why no one else has done this before. I keep thinking it's so obvious. Like, why isn't it done before? I think, oh, maybe there's a reason why. And it has strengths and weaknesses, doesn't it? That you do something different. I mean, the risk is it falls between that, you know, that crime readers might think it's too sci-fi and sci-fi writers think it's too crimey, or so who knows. But I do believe, you know, one writer I heard speak at a conference whose name escapes me said you have to trust that every story will find its way to the reader who needs it at that time. You know, so whether or not that's separate from the charts, but there are books mean something to everybody, don't they? Your stories, and all you can hope for is that your story will find its way to the person who needs to read that.
And let's talk about the book title and the book cover. Have you been involved in that process? How has it all been? How has it worked for you?
So from day one, I called it In the Blink of an Eye. And originally, it was because it focuses on two missing boys. I think because I wanted a crime. Obviously, I was obsessed with love and loss and grief at the time. And so I think that's why I was drawn to writing about missing people. Because I think that's a particular... probably one of the most awful losses, the ambiguity of it, living with that uncertainty is an almost unimaginable pain and loss. So, and in the blink of an eye, at the time I wrote it, was about how someone can be there one day, 1 second, and then gone in the next, literally in the blink of an eye, when people go missing. So that's what I was referencing when I wrote it. But then as I worked more on the AI aspect, I did more research. One of the books I read was Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, and that was about how humans make decisions, how some people make things that is a gut instinct, that, you know, a millisecond, during which time they're processing lots of subconscious information, sort of how we make decisions, which became sort of a key theme of the book, because obviously the way that Locke makes decisions is very different from how Kat makes it. She uses her hunches, her gut instinct, but also every human, we all make decisions differently. Some are much more evidential as opposed to instinct. So it plays off those two things. And no one ever even suggested that we change it, which was good. And in terms of the cover, that was fantastic. It's Richard Valestra from Simon Schuster. He designed it for the proof. And again, that was very teamwork. We tried out lots of different covers to try and get it right for the proof for Harrogate. And originally, on the inside covers, we had a half shot of sort of Cat's body with one eye showing, and on the back inside cover, half of Locke with half of its eye showing. And there were such powerful images. I said to Richard, couldn't we stick them together and put that on the front? And he just went, ah, yes. And he went away and made this amazing cover that's been on the proof. And then the illustrators, I'm just really went with that. And I'm just so pleased with the cover and the trailer that I sent you today as well. I just love it.
And so did you get to go to Harrogate then with your proof and just have an amazing time?
Yes, I did, which is my first ever crime festival. To say, because I'd wanted to, I saw these tweets about how much fun people were having in, I think it was 2016. And I always wanted to go. And then my husband became very ill, so I couldn't. And obviously then the pandemic and my youngest is very ill, so I've been very much housebound for more years than I care to think about. And so this summer, I was finally able to go just for one day and one night, because I've still got caring responsibilities. But it was very exciting just to go out and go to a crime festival and meet so many wonderful. Quite overwhelming, actually, I have to say as well, because I took me, yeah. But it was everything people say about the crime community being the kindest and the friendly and the most supportive. It is all true. It is amazing. And I went to Capital Crime as well in September in London just for the day. And just Yeah, just people are really supportive of each. People have been so supportive to me. As you say, it's such a competitive space in terms of lots of books out. But people are very welcoming and they generally want you to do well. They remember what it's like to be a debut author. Really, really quite moving.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. I mean, yes, to have wanted to go to Harrogate, to be there and with the proof of your book and get the support.
It's very bizarre. It is very weird. Quite surreal. And yeah, and then other friends saying, because you... I find it very hard to sort of ask. So with my editor, Catherine Armstrong, I arrived and she introduced me to another author. I think it's Brian McGilloway, lovely man. This is, you've got to read Joe's book. It's so great. I was like, oh, you don't have to. It's okay. Sorry. And he was really busy. You don't have to read my book. And she was saying, stop saying that to people. Everyone I was meeting was saying, you don't have to read it. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I've written a book.
I know, don't mind me. So Catherine and my the press person Jess, they're very gently beating that out of me.
Well, you need to be shouting about this book because it's brilliant and we are thoroughly supporting you and your journey. So Joe Callahan, who's the author of In the Blink of an Eye, thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you, I love that, gosh.
Coming up next, another author interview and more book reviews.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
What I'm going to do next is tell you about the other books. Then we're going to have Elle coming on to talk to us about her book, which is great. And also at the end, I'm going to talk about what the lovely Facebook group is reading at the moment, because there are lots of books being read that we need to talk about. So let's get started on the books. I'll leave the description of The Man I Never Met till the end, because that will tie in very nicely, hopefully, with the chat with Elle. So the next book I'm going to talk to you about is Daisy Darker by Alice Feeney. Let me read you the blurb on this. Daisy Darker's family were as dark can be. When one of them died, all of them lied and pretended not to see. Daisy Darker is arriving at her grandmother's house for her 80th birthday. It is Halloween and sea glass, the crumbling Cornish house, perched upon its own tiny private island, is at one with the granite rocks it sits on. The Darker family haven't all been in the same place for over a decade. And when the tide comes in, They'll be cut off from the rest of the world for 8 hours. When the tide goes back out, nothing will ever be the same again because one of them is a killer. Let's do first sentence and then I have things to say about this. I really do. Chapter 1. I was born with a broken heart. The day I arrived into this lonely little world was also the first time I died. Nobody spotted the heart condition back then. Things weren't as sophisticated in 1975 as they might be now. And my blue colouring was blamed on my traumatic birth. I'm going to leave it there, but this book. Now, you might think, oh, they're all on an island and they can't get off for so long and they need to wait for the tides to go down. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. No, you haven't. This book is something else. And if you like books with a twist, you need to attach a neck brace onto yourself before you start reading this book. It was one of those where I was just like, what? And once you've read this book, please can you send me a message because I need to talk to you about this book and what happened. Goodness me, it took a change. I'm sorry for that squeal. It's a noisy book there, isn't it? I just thought it was a great read. If someone says to you, I'm looking for a book, but I specifically want it to have the twist, this is the one to show them. And I know I keep going on about the twist, so then you'll read it and say, what twist? She overdid the talk, the twist talk. And maybe I have, but still let me know when you've read this because I need to talk to people about this book. So that is Daisy Darker. Next, we're going to go on to The Bleeding by Johanna Gustafsson. And as I say, this was mentioned, Karen from Arenda Books mentioned this as one of the books at this time to be reading. So let me read you the blurb of this. 1899, Belle Epoque, Paris. Lucienne's two daughters are believed dead when her mansion burns down to the ground, but she is certain that her girls are still alive and embarks on a journey into the depths of the spiritualist community to find them. 1949, post-war Quebec. Teenager Lena's father has died in the French resistance, and as she struggles to fit in at school, her mother introduces her to an elderly woman at the asylum where she works, changing Lena's life in the darkest way imaginable. 2002, Quebec. A former schoolteacher is accused of brutally stabbing her husband, a famous university professor, to death. Detective Maxine Grant, who has recently lost her own husband and is parenting a teenager and a new baby single-handedly, takes on the investigation. Under enormous personal pressure, Maxine makes a series of macabre discoveries that link directly to historical cases involving black magic and murder, secret societies and spiritism. Spiritism? Spiritualism? Either. And women at breaking point who will stop at nothing to protect the ones they love. Let's do first sentence before I tell you what I think. Chapter 1. Maxine, 2002. My car skips off the paved road and sways like a boat set afloat. I'm navigating the potholes, one stomp on the accelerator at a time. Bloody hell. The tyres are screeching, biting into the gravel and its coating of frost, spitting crud onto the verge, then crunching back on track. What did I think of this book? I thought this book was a wow. I thought it was unsettling, powerful. You have to pay attention to it, but it's beautifully written. I mean, it could have been written by Margaret Atwood, I felt. It's that sort of style of writing. Yes, there are these three different time frames. Did that put me off? Did that confuse me? No, it didn't. It offered me something different. And I know I keep going about how I like different books, but this delivered it. Bravo, Johanna, bravo, Arenda Books. The Bleeding is a superb, different, compelling story. I thought it was very good indeed. So the next book is The Confession by Maureen Myant. And this is the one that Hobeck Books were saying was one of theirs to read and look out for. Let's look at the blurb, shall we? A house on a quiet street on the south side of Glasgow. Neat terraced homes, not the sort of place that reeks of decay or where dead blue bottles pile up on a windowsill. When the police break in, there's a surprise in store for them. They find Julie Campbell's decaying body at her desk, her laptop open beside her. She's a well-liked, respectable woman. On the laptop is a confession to 5 murders. There's one major problem, though. Only one of the victims she names is actually dead. DI Mark Nicholson is persuaded by his boss, DCI Alex Scrimgeour, that the confession is a fantasy and to drop the case. But Mark senses there's more to it than meets the eye. As he delves further, the darkest of secrets are revealed and everyone around him is dragged into a vortex of fear, danger and murder. No one is beyond suspicion as the confession becomes a murderous reality. Now, let's go for first sentence, shall we? Sorry, there's a few pages. The reason why I'm sounding like this, I did, once I'd spoken to Arinda Books and Hobet Books, I ordered this one and it was on pre-order. So I was hoping to get it in plenty of time to read and review it today. But sadly, I was advised by the website that shall not be named that my order was delayed. So I've had to go on the old Kindle. Nothing wrong with that at all. But that's why it's just taken me a few minutes to navigate to find the first sentence again. But here we go. Are you sitting comfortably? Prologue, June 29th, 2019. One blue bottle can lay 600 eggs in a day. DS Mark Nicholson donned the protective bodysuit before following the police constable into the house. He blinked as his eyes adjusted to the darkness. He was breathing through his mouth, but it didn't help. The stench was overwhelming. So what's the story? He asked. Well, this is a book that, first of all, I thought, oh, it's this sort of book, fine, I know. And then it changes like, oh, it's this sort of book. And then, oh my goodness, it's a story that evolves as you're reading. I thought it was really well written. It's just a great story. It's something, again, different. That's the theme of the week. I'd like to say I chose these books for the theme, but I didn't. I'm afraid it's just pure chance. But it's something, again, different. And that's what I think is so good. I enjoyed reading it on the Kindle. Shock, what's going on with me? I thought it was really well plotted and written and presented. And yeah, it's a really astonishing book. Excellent. Bravo. Bravo to Maureen. Bravo to Hobeck. And shame on me for not reading this that book before. I need to be on the case more and support independent publishers more, as I've said. I'm repeating myself. Let me move on. The final book, The Man I Never Met by L. Cook. Listen, two lives are about to be changed by one phone call. When Davy misdials Hannah's number, at first they think nothing of it. After all, Davy lives in Texas and Hannah lives in London. But when Davy gets a job in London, their paths are sure to cross. As messaging turns into video calling, this feels like the start of something. Weeks later, Hannah is waiting for Davy at the airport, but he never walks into arrivals. When Hannah finds out why, her world is turned on its head. And with their future so uncertain, each must pick up the pieces of their lives. Right, let's go to chapter one. Hannah, December. Do you remember where you were and what you were doing the moment your life changed forever? I do. I was standing outside the gym, hair in a bit of a tangle, in need of a shower after a grueling spin class, rifling in my bag for my gloves while my mobile buzzed away. But of course, I didn't know it at the time. That's always how it is, though, isn't it? You never realise the true significance of a moment until later. I really enjoyed this book. Again, it was different. It's a much lighter story than some of the others that I've talked about today. I thought it had the surprises, the twists, and characters that I believed in, which I liked. I just love this concept of, well, I'll talk to Elle about it and we can go into more detail for you. But I just thought it was a really different approach to a story and I really enjoyed it. So let's go and talk to Elle now. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Elle Cook, whose book is The Man I Never Met. Elle, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I just have to jump in with my first question for you. When you had the idea for this book, were you excited just to get sat down and start writing this?
Yes, oh my gosh, massively, I was. I had the idea in the first lockdown and it wouldn't leave me alone. And I had previously written historical novels, so didn't want to jump out of that arena at all, really, for fear that it wouldn't work. So actually, I never even told my agent I was writing it or ask any approval from her at all. I just sat down and did it because I didn't want to say, oh, I had this idea and oh, I don't know if it's going to work. And blah. So I just sat down and I just got on with it over, I wrote it over about a year throughout those first crazy lockdowns that we kept having on and off when I had time in between my other work. And at the end of it, I, you know, brushed up on it, thought about it, wasn't quite sure what to do with it, and then sort of sent it to her and said, I've got something to show you, which was the entire novel. Poor woman.
Oh, but obviously the response was good, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. All the stars and the planets were in alignment. Essentially, it's about two people who are meant to be together, but don't seem to quite be able to make it happen for a great portion of the book. It's essentially that.
I loved it that, you know, someone just misdials and there's this connection. It's almost, you know, you hear about this Love is Blind TV show where people get to know each other without seeing each other. And it's just how you can connect to someone and you just know there's something special about this person. Again, how did you get that idea?
That is just one of those funny things that just popped into my head. And I wanted something that wasn't massively unrealistic and that was very believable, but that could very easily happen. Not that many people use phone as a phone anymore. It's messaging, or you're checking your email or your social media. But weirdly enough, another author friend who had read the book and been kind enough to blurb it sent me a message saying the weirdest thing just happened to me. Like, you know, a few weeks ago. So this does happen. Said I just got a missed call from this guy in Spain, completely misdialed me by mistake. And we had a little chat and I said goodbye. So then I thought of you immediately. And I was like, see, it does happen. And then my follow up question was, and was he hot? And she said, yes, I've looked at his WhatsApp and he was hot. Like, yeah, this does happen in real life.
Was she already practicing the signature with his surname?
She's happily married, so she let that one slide.
Oh, okay, fair enough. That's not going to go any further there. But no, that I just love that. And you're right, we normally have phones numbers preset now in our phones. So to get a random call, yes, is more special. And that certainly came through in the book. I mean, we meet Hannah and Davy straight away in the story. How did those characters first appear to you?
How did they first appear to me? I guess, weirdly, I'd been thinking about Hannah, I think, more than I'd been thinking about Davy. And I'd been thinking about the kind of book I'd want to write if I was going to start writing contemporary. I was thinking about the kind of books that really speak to me. I read quite widely, not massively widely, but quite widely. I read a lot of historical fiction because that's my other job. I read a bit of crime thriller. I've sort of moved into that. That's been my sort of post-lockdown joy. I've discovered crime thriller, which I never sort of was into before. And I've really got so much more into contemporary fiction and women's fiction. And there are things I've worked out that I love about that genre. And I think it's when you find a really likeable, funny main character who is quite realistic, is not weighed down with a whole bunch of prior baggage. I think I'm obviously very specific in what I like. So I just read a Sophia Money Coutts novel and it's funny and the heroine is all of those things and more. And I think I've realised that's the kind of main character I love and that's the kind of main character I try to write. So Hannah sort of appeared in my head as just this really kind of hopefully fun, not too cool, a bit of an in-betweener maybe, like a nice person. Just fun and friendly, not buckets of friends so you'd feel jealous of her from afar, but, you know, a nice amount. So I just tried to make her a really normal person. So she appeared in my head, I think April 2020. And then she was shortly followed by Davy and his story. And the two of them were in my head for a few months before I could do anything about them, really. But they sat there waiting.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes, nice, normal. There's nothing wrong with that because they're more relatable. You can, you know, understand what they're going through. And we care about them more probably as well. I'm interested in the twist because you say you started reading more crime and thrillers. And obviously that isn't what this book is at all. And yet there are twists in it. And I'm just interested when you said that's something that you've been getting more into as a genre for reading. And it's almost like I could see how that has affected your writing. It was great, the sort of the surprises as you go along.
Yeah, I do love a little twist every now and again. My daughter's only 11, but she's been learning about writing at school. And she said to me, we were talking about writing books, and she said to me, oh, we all know what a good book is. It's a beginning, a middle, and a twist. And I thought, oh, and you're 11. So, I mean, I'm not a big subscriber that every book must have a twist at all. But if there is one coming, it's nice to sort of not guess what it is. And it's nice to be surprised in novels rather than to always think, oh, well, I know exactly where this is going. Sometimes that's nice. But sometimes it is nice to turn the page and go, oh, I did not guess that was going to happen as well. So it's a good mashup. It's a good mix, you know, to have them all in your life.
And how do you manage to get the sort of love levels right? How do you balance it when you've still got those twists? Is that a challenge for you?
Yeah, well, I kind of knew that I wanted to keep them. They're right for each other. This couple are, in my head, they're right for each other. And I hope that comes across. But I wanted to keep the reader invested in them, even though they're afar for part of the book, because they are hopefully both very likeable, but hopefully you know they're both right for each other, and you know that what they go through, you know, in the 18 months of the novel, you know that they are supposed to be, you know, together in the end. And so hopefully the love levels, while they're not always on page together, is enough that you think, oh my God, just one of you do something.
Yeah, so we get really quite involved in urging them along to,
yeah, exactly, hopefully.
Yes, quite. Did you always know how it would turn out?
I did. I didn't know how we were going to get there, but I kind of, in my head, I kind of have the beginning of the book and I have the end of the book, and that's the only bit I really plot. I think I'm a bit of a mashup of a plotter and a pantser, and I think I know where I'm going, and I you know, I know how it's going to start, I know how it's going to end. But how we get there is a winding pathway. And it's fun that way for me. I can explore different things as we go. And hopefully it's fun for the reader as well, because it's not, I tried to plot with my first book in my historical fiction. I think I plotted to within an inch of its life. And, you know, you have to redraft and redraft. You think, I'm trying to force these characters into doing something that I really want them to do. But actually, when they're on page and dialogue is flowing, and you think, oh, that's not the right direction for them. So it is nice to be able to sort of give them free rein and let them do what they kind of want to do.
So when you were writing your historical books, this is your first book that isn't the historical fiction, I believe. I was going to say, was the process different? And you've said it was, because the plotting was so much more.
I think the process is different for every single book I write. I never seem to write anything the same way. I'm not sure that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe I'm learning as I go. But every time I think, I write down all these notes, and then maybe I'll lose those notes and I'll think, I'll have to start again anyway. So I like that it goes, it's a different direction every time. It keeps things interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what made you want to make that change in genre? Was it just, it was about the story rather than the topic?
I think it was about, so when I write my historicals, I've often written dual narratives. So there is always a contemporary strand, and then there's something in the past, and the past informs the present, but the present characters will always have something similar going on, you know, that there's a romance in both sections. And so I've written contemporary as part of my historicals, and so it didn't feel too different to do that. But I was very aware that wasn't the genre in which I sat for the last 4 or so years. So it did feel like a bit of a risk. But I did want to sort of break free a little bit while doing both at the same time. And I thought, I just had this story. It wasn't, I will do a contemporary and I must find a story. It was very much that this sat in my head during that first lockdown. I thought, I've just got to do something with this now, because it's just in there and it won't go away. You know, I've had ideas over the years that have sat in my head and then they've just gently drifted out. And I thought, well, they're not the right ones for me. But this one just would not leave me alone, really.
Now we're sitting here, it's sort of a week and a bit until publication day. And when this episode goes out, it'll be a couple of days after publication day. So I'm just interested, how does it feel now with the anticipation? Does it feel different? Are you more, because it's a, well, it's not a risk because it's a great book, but do you know what I mean? It's something different for you. Does it feel different at this stage?
I'm trying not to let it feel different.
Until I mentioned it.
Let it feel, Yeah, I'm trying. No, I have been thinking about it, but I am thinking about it a lot more. I'm getting a lot of emails from agents, editors and things. And it's lovely because I've got a US deal as well. So I'm sort of getting it from transatlantic points of view as well, and retailers that it's going into and things like that. So I'm just thinking, oh no, it's fine. It's just another book. It's just fine. And just trying to plod along without thinking too much about it.
Is the process quite different when you've got when it's being published in the US as well? Are the edits different, the book cover?
Yeah. There are. I've had US deals as part of my historicals, but it's always been sort of to get bundled together in a sort of English language deal. So this is different because this is a US deal, which has been, you know, purchased separately. And so it's lovely to see how the Americans do things differently and the language they want you to use and just kind of how they approach things slightly differently. So I've had edits for US and edits for UK, but both editors have worked alongside each other. So it's kind of all been reflected in both manuscripts the same. It's quite lovely. It's an interesting process. Full on, but interesting nonetheless.
Yes, it's not just, oh, they want to publish it in the US, as you say, and oh, that's lovely, I'll sit back and let it happen. It's, yeah, quite full on.
Yeah, it's really great.
So when you're writing, do you have to write in a particular place and have the same sort of drink to hand? Is there a process with that?
No, I've learned not to be too precious because I find myself floating all over the house depending on like whether a tap is broken and a plumber needs to come in and stuff, you know, so I can't sit quietly. So at the minute I'm in my dining room because I'm at home on my own. My husband's been working away for a couple of months. So I find my office is at the top of the house because we're in a townhouse. So I find myself having to run up and down the stairs to like sort of open door to couriers or open door to postman, and I don't get anything done. It's good for my exercise levels, so I've just relocated to the dining room now because it's easier for my lazy self to be able to get up and move around a bit more and make coffee. I've got good access to the coffee machine down here, which is not to be overlooked. But no, I just start my day and I get going really, and I usually am in my office or not at the minute, but yeah, I just sit down and just go for it. So yeah, no real routine, open laptop, hope for the best.
But you used to work in PR, didn't you? So I imagine you're used to, if words need to be produced, sitting down and getting on with it rather than waiting for the muse to strike you. And
yeah, I've learned not to wait for the muse to strike because nothing would ever happen if I do that. I will always find something to do to pretend I'm getting the muse to work, which is basically going on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. So I've had to just learn not to do that. No, it is just a case of sit down and get on with it, really. PR was more about writing the odd press release and chasing journalists and taking people out for lunches, which was very lovely, but not massively creative. So it is nice to sit. I do need a lot of quiet. That's the one thing I do need. I can't be one of these people who works in coffee shops, which is so sad. I'm really annoyed about that because I just listen to other people and then, you know, or like get up and order another coffee or worry if I've been at a table for too long and are they going to get annoyed at me because I've been nursing this latte for an hour and a half. So I get a bit nervous about that. So I'm like, no, I'll just sit at home and it's all nice and quiet. And as long as the doorbell doesn't ring, I can usually just immerse myself in it. I can't even listen to music, which is the tragic thing, or have podcasts on in the background or anything. So just pure quiet, which is a bit sad.
And can you eat when you're writing, or are you an author who cannot have any food?
No. I don't know. No, not really. I guess I just come downstairs and I, depending on how deep into my edits I am, I will probably eat fairly unhealthily and I'll probably just stand up over the cooker, shove a sandwich in my face and run back upstairs again. It's not the healthiest way to live.
So you're not actually eating while you're writing? You do keep
No, that is the break. That's the only break I probably have is, you know, grab a coffee, stand, eat sandwich, run away again. So no, I can't do that. It's probably a good thing. Otherwise I'd probably just sit and pick all day at something.
So how long does it take to know when an idea can be a book?
It's a case of whether it leaves you alone or not. For me, it was very much a case of whether I can shift an idea out of my head, whether I can actually see the ending. If I can see the ending and I can generally see how we're going to get there, although I'm prepared for that to change. If I can see a beginning and an end, but I can't work out what on earth would go in the middle, that's probably not. That's a bit of a non-starter probably. And I've had a few of those in my head that, oh, this would be lovely, you know, but if I can't see that it would grip me, then it wouldn't grip a reader. So I kind of have to bin it. But it's not really a case of time. It's definitely a case of whether an idea sits around and pushes at you in your brain for a while, I think.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yes, I'm great at having ideas, but then I forget them, or yes, I lose interest in them. But yes, that's it. If an idea is there knocking on your mind, there's a reason for it.
Yeah, if you've lost interest in it, then it's probably a good idea to get rid of it. Forgetting the idea, that's terrible. I've got a memory like a sieve these days. So I think I had a great idea. In my head, I'm sure it was a great idea. It felt like a great idea in the middle of the night. And I thought, this is so good. I will remember this. And it's gone. It'll never come back again. So write them down. That's what I say. Have a little notepad or just get your notes out on your phone and write them down. Because often when I'm sort of not sleeping, but drifting off, you know, or waking up slowly in the morning, these are when my ideas sort of comes to me. When I've got that thinking time, you need thinking time as a writer, and like, you know, you don't really always get that very often. You've got kids, or you've got a day job, or you've got running around to do. So actual pure, oh, what about this idea time doesn't really hit you. It's usually when I'm laying down. So that's when I'm like, oh gosh, get the notes out, start typing something.
But that's true. The ideas that I've had that I've then forgotten what they were, I always think those were the best ideas, you know, blockbuster book in the making. Yeah. And yet actually, yeah, if I'd written it down, I'd have probably looked at it and thought, what?
That's it. Don't mourn their losses. Write them off, move on.
Yes, exactly. So can we just talk about how you got an agent first of all?
What's the story with that? I joined the Romantic Novelist Association New Writers Scheme back in 2017, I think it was. And as part of that, you sort of pay a really small fee, and they assign you an editor, basically, from their pool of writers, and you submit your manuscript, and they read. Do they do all of it? Yeah, they do. They read all of it, and they give you a great report back to tell you, you know, what kind of things you should change or what you've done well, or, you know, just hints and tips. And on the back of that, I got recommended a few agents that work quite closely with the RNA. And I ended up at one of their conferences. I think it was the 2018 conference, and managed to pitch to some agents there. And while I didn't end up with any of them, that was my sort of starting ground for understanding how the process works. And then I approached my agent now, who is Becky Ritchie at AM Heath, and I loved some of the authors that she worked with, and that's how I discovered her, because I read Iona Gray and Jenny Ashcroft's novels and loved them, and everybody, you know, thanks their agent in the back of their book. And so I went there and had a look, and, you know, both these authors were thanking Becky Ritchie, and I was like, oh, I will give her an email. And that's kind of how it happened. I just sat in her slush pile and waited to be picked up.
Oh, but that's wonderful, and that's a really good tip for someone that's thinking of sending their book to an agent. Which agent? Look for the authors that you love and look for who their agents
definitely.
Are.
That's the way I did it. I was just very lucky, I think. Right place, right time.
Well, no, it's down to hard work as well. And that pays off, especially that time when you know you've got an agent. It's just wonderful. So if you could go back in time to when you were there writing that first book, what would you whisper to yourself? What would you tell yourself?
Maybe not when I was writing it, but I would say after I wrote it, I was under the impression that once I had an agent, that was it. I'd done, sorted, didn't have to worry ever again. And I think maybe that's a good thing to have. Maybe that's a good blind idea to have, and to stick with that, that innately. I think it's a case of just hold on. I just tell myself to hold on, because you don't know what's coming. Ups and downs, peaks and troughs. You just, you know, take it all with a pinch of salt, and don't be scared to ask for help, definitely. Because we don't know, when you're a debut, you don't know what's coming. You might have certain ideas of things and not know, which is why I quite like those groups on Facebook, you know, the author groups, because I think the industry is very, they know what they're doing. And I think often agents, editors maybe think we know more than we know. But we're like, no, we're sort of that child tugging at the teacher's skirt. Like, can I just ask you a question? Which I think my poor agent was full of her inbox. Can I just ask you another question? Maybe someone needs to write a manual for us. But yeah, hold on and take it with a pinch of salt, I would say.
Oh, no, that's wonderful. Well, great book. Can't wait to read what you write next. Elle Cook, who's written The Man I Never Met. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So those are your five books. Just to do a recap, we've had In the Blink of an Eye by Joe Callahan, Daisy Darker by Alice Feeney, The Bleeding by Johanna Gustafson, The Confession by Maureen Myant, and of course, The Man I Never Met by Elle Cook. So those are the books. But before you leave me, I need to talk about what the lovely Facebook group has been reading. Or I should say, from next week on, there should just be one interview per episode because I think it's getting a bit long. Occasionally there'll be two, but that's what I'm aiming for. I hope that's okay. Let me know if it's not. Always happy to change it. It's just lovely hearing your views on things. It just helps me so much. So do let me know. So let's talk about what the wonderful Facebook group are reading. Amy is reading Eeny Meeny by A.J. Aldridge and also listening to Reputation by Sarah Vaughan on Audible. Fantastic, great books, Amy. Love those. Nick is reading Sealed with a Kiss by Rachel Lucas. Fiona's reading 1989 by Val McDermid. Of course, Val's come on the podcast. Kate is reading The Book of Two Ways by Jodie Picoult. I love Jodie's book so much. Kate is reading The Bingo Hall Detectives, yes, by Jonathan Whitelaw. We love that one. Rob has got hold of a copy of Madly Deeply by Alan Rickman, although he says it was quite hard, surprisingly hard to find. So, Rob, hope you're enjoying that one. Trace is reading Reminders of Him by Colleen Hoover. Colleen obviously is all over TikTok. Tracy, you need to tell us what you think about that book. Do I need to be including these books on this podcast? Maybe I should. Maybe I've failed you so far. I need to know, Tracy. Julie is reading I Am Pilgrim by Terry Hayes. Oh my goodness, I love that book so much. I keep waiting for the next one. And there are some significant delays in it being published. But yeah, I Am Pilgrim, great. If you like thrillers, great book. Rebecca's reading Where the Crawdads Sing. And she says, I know I'm late to the party, but doesn't matter, you read the book when you're ready. Hope you're enjoying that one. Natalie's reading Wrong Place, Wrong Time by Gillian McAllister. Leslie is reading, oh, she's got two on the go. I love this. She's got an upstairs book, which is 1979 by Val McDermid. And then her downstairs book is Other Parents by Sarah Stovall, and she's enjoying them both. Amanda's reading The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Great book. Janet's halfway through Milkman by Anna Burns and says it's fantastic writing. Well done, Janet. I haven't read that. I think you need to be in the right sort of frame of mind to read that. So well done, Janet. Bravo. Sally's reading Anne Veronica by H.G. Wells. She's read it three times and only just noticed who the author was. So that's great. Must be a good one then. Elizabeth's about to start The Retreat by Sarah Pierce. Hope you enjoy that, Elizabeth. Glynis has got two books on the go. She's reading Odd Boy Out by Giles Brandreth and The Crossing by Michael Connolly. Yeah, we had Michael on recently. Lauren says she's usually a massive reader of thrillers and crimes, but she's currently reading Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus and enjoying it. Yeah, I love that book so much. Currently trying badly to put my top 10 for the year together, and it may or may not feature on that. Ellen's reading After Dark and The Butterfly Room. Great, Ellen, that's super. And Murid's reading Blackbird House short stories by Alice Hoffman and To Be a Man by Nicole Krauss. She's saying they're both wonderful compilations, but in very different styles. Oh, yes. And she says when she's lost her reading mojo, she goes back to quality short stories to get her reading mojo back. That's a really good point. It would be worth us doing an episode on what to do when your reading mojo is gone. But currently, I don't have time to lose my reading mojo. I've got to keep reading because we've got some books next week. Dare I say it? Dare I mention the C word to you? Yes, I'm going to. So next week, it's the Christmas books episode. I will be teaming up with Lauren from the books again, from YouTube. And we will be going through our current favourites, our top five Christmas reads for this year. Lauren's very kindly joined me for 2 years before. This is our third year, and it's always a lot of fun. And I know you've been asking that episode be earlier on in December, because I often put it on just before Christmas. So it's there. It's the first week's episode in December for you. So sorry to keep going on about the word Christmas. There will be quite a few Christmas books over the next few weeks, but there will be others. There's just some great books to talk to you about. Can't wait. Anyway, I've talked, I've blathered, you've listened, I appreciate it, but I need to send you on your way now. So just look after yourselves and I'll talk to you very soon. Take care now. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the QuickBook Reviews podcast. That's enough books, said no one, ever. See you again soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.